You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us. Hello, Hellions. I'm Annie.
And I'm Johanna. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of your, hopefully, favorite international podcast.
International indeed. Johanna and I just started tracking our listeners, and now we can see how many people are listening, which was a really pleasant surprise, actually. And we can see where you're listening from.
Well, we knew that most of our listeners come from the US and Canada, obviously, but now we know you're from Australia, the UK, Austria, Germany, Poland, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Malta, Greece, Malaysia.
Yep, Singapore, Italy, the Cayman Islands, Trinidad and Tobago. Hey, Lauren. And Palestine. And actually, a whole bunch of new listeners from Puerto Rico.
¿Qué onda? Saludos a Puerto Rico de Viena.
Bienvenidos a los boricuas. You know, one of my favorite Spanish idioms. I think it's Puerto Rican, and it would actually be useful for this podcast. It's aquí hay gato encerrado. So it means there's a cat locked up in here. It's what you would say instead of, you know, there's something fishy going on. So we might be able to use that in a future episode because there's often a cat locked up in here in our stories.
True. But you know what? I'm still missing my friends from Mexico among our listeners.
Hey, come on, get on it already, guys.
Well, nevertheless, this week, to celebrate the fact we're doing so much better than we thought we were, we decided to do a special episode with cases from some of these countries who are listening to us.
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to do a bunch of shorter stories, things that, you know, they're really great stories out there, but they often just don't have enough info for like a full episode. So we're going to cover some of those. And don't worry, if your country didn't make the list, we promise we're going to cover something soon.
Definitely. And I'm really looking forward to these stories. Annie, would you like to start?
I would love to. Okay, so I have got a murder in Malta, and this one is bad. Malta is an archipelago, so like a group of islands. It's located in the Mediterranean Sea, about 80 kilometers or 50 miles south of Italy. So in Malta, they speak both English and Maltese, which I'm told sounds like Arabic. The three largest islands of this island chain, Malta, Gozo, and Comino, are inhabited. People live on those three. So it's a really beautiful and ancient country. And unfortunately, it seems to have a problem with setting women on fire. On April 3rd, 1993, a charred body was discovered in a still smoldering car. Investigators realized that they were dealing with a female victim when they turned the body over and discovered that there was a burned bra strap. Anthony Abela Medici, he headed up the forensic investigation at the time, and he remembered it as one of the worst cases Malta had ever seen because it did involve a woman being burned alive. He said that the first clue about the victim's identity was actually a gold pendant in the shape of a bowling pin. Sylvia King, who was a 36-year-old social worker, had just recently won the national bowling championships. I think it was just 4 days earlier. But in order to figure out conclusively who their victim was, they had to compare dental records. And they were able to obtain dental records from Northern Ireland, where she had lived for a time. And they found that, unfortunately, it was a match for Sylvia King.
I mean, it's good they found the dental records, but did they find anything else?
I mean, only things that are going to make you sad. So they found parts of the car's, the windows were shattered, and they had melted with the heat of the fire. So parts of that, like, melted glass were found underneath her head. So that suggested she was alive and struggling after the fire had started, which is awful. Their theory unfortunately proved to be correct when at autopsy they found soot in her windpipe. So you knew that she was breathing when the fire was going. But they also found two very heavy blows to the head. And if they were able to find evidence of two blows to the head with her body being so badly burned, then I'm going to assume that she was hit hard enough to fracture her skull and leave some kind of mark that they could conclusively see. So that probably would have knocked her out. For my own sanity, I'm just going to assume that she was unconscious when she died.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Sylvia's purse, including her personal diary and a couple of guns that they believed were probably used to abduct her, they were later found in a field in Zabar. So evidence eventually led the cops to a known drug addict, a guy named Tony Baldacchino. He gave the police a detailed confession, claiming that he had wanted to stop Joseph Harrington, but he feared that if he tried to prevent the murder, that he would also be killed.
Wait, who are those men? How do they know her?
Yeah, you're going to hate this so much. Sylvia volunteered with an organization that helped women in abusive relationships. One of those women was the estranged wife of a guy named Joseph Harrington, and he had somehow tracked down Sylvia in an attempt to find his wife. So they kidnapped Sylvia just as she was leaving the Lemon and Lime bar that she owned in, all right, hopefully I pronounced this right. I would say Marsa Scala. They tied her up and they burned her alive. A few years later, a memorial for Sylvia was erected, and I have a photo of her and of the memorial that I'll share in the Facebook group. Richard Harrington, he was convicted of the murder in 2000, and he was sent to prison for life, but he died in prison. I think he actually died in a prison hospital in 2014. And Tony Baldacchino, he was convicted in a separate trial in 1997. He was actually released from prison in 2002, I assume because he was less involved and actually made solving the crime possible. But he was found dead the next year, presumably from a heroin overdose.
This is a very, very sad case.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad. And I tried to find out some more information on Sylvia so I could talk a little bit more about this woman whose life was just taken so senselessly, but I just really couldn't find anything in English. She seemed like a beautiful person inside and out, very talented bowler, which seems to be a sport that she excelled at. And she ended up giving her life because she was kind.
And it's stories like these that are especially heartbreaking.
I know. It's just awful. All right. So let me now tell you some good things about Malta. I really want to visit, not just because of the lovely people and the amazing food, beautiful beaches. You know, I love a beach. But Malta has one of the coolest, oldest, ancient underground structures in the world. I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong. It's the Hypogeum. Hypogeum means underground in Greek, and it's the Hall Cephlini Hypogeum. It's a multi-level subterranean Neolithic burial ritual complex. There we go. That's a copy and paste. Located in Paola. So it dates back to around 4000 to 2500 BCE, and it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The acoustic properties of the oracle room that's located in there, they've been studied extensively by researchers all over the world, and apparently it's remarkable, and this is so cool. So I guess anything that's spoken in that room, even if you just whisper, you can hear it throughout the entire hypogeum on all three levels, and the acoustics are staggering. So I'd probably want to sing and then be asked to leave.
I think it's a hypogeum.
Well, now you tell me.
Annie, please tell me, do you get asked to leave places often? Because you burst into songs?
Allegedly. No, not really. Never for singing. I was once told that I would be asked to leave because I did an interpretive dance on a tour. But that's a story for another day. So, yeah. So another fascinating aspect of them finding the hypogeum. So another really cool aspect of this thing were that they found... I'm just not going to say it. Or that they found more than 7,000 people, they believe, documented burials there. And so the thing that's crazy about it, though, is there are allegedly a lot of very strange looking skulls.
Strange in what way?
So they're super elongated. Some of them, I think, that they believe were intentionally elongated. I guess that was a thing back in the day that you see in different cultures. But not all of the skulls that were found were artificially enlarged. Some of them are apparently just naturally very long. So like if you imagine, I'm trying to imagine what it would be.
Like Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
Oh, I fell asleep like 20 minutes in and then Paul
said
not
for Bob. That movie doesn't exist for me, but I heard.
Yeah, like at the top of the bat, like if the crown of your head kept going up, you know.
The cool heads.
No, not Conehead, like back further. Like
Yeah, okay.
if the Coneheads are like a high 80s ponytail, this would be more like, 90s high ponytail. So still up there, but like not, So a lot of people, of course, think that it's aliens. Listen, I'm not saying it's aliens, but might be aliens. But others think that, well, it's a much ado about nothing, right? Because I guess there's different styles of skull shape just naturally. So some people have more rounded skulls, some are more elongated. And so some people say that there's nothing to it. But they've just funded a really, really extensive study on these specific skulls. Literally just, I think last week, they got funding and announced that they were going to do some testing on this. So I will keep you updated when we learn more. The other really non-creepy cool thing I found about Malta is they have a craft village there. Now I know that that's like, oh yeah, okay, well, who doesn't have a craft village? But theirs is built on an old RAF, so England's the Royal Air Force. So the English built an air base, like an airfield, before the Second World War on Malta. Today, a whole bunch of the military huts and buildings have been converted into these sort of workshops and artist studios where Maltese craftsmen and artists create their work. And it's the Takali, I believe is how you pronounce it, craft village. It just sounds like somewhere that I would spend a lot of money. I really love local art and I really want to go to Malta. Have you been?
I have only been there as a flight attendant, but I didn't leave the airplane. It was just quick turnarounds.
It's just like looking out the window at a place you can't go.
Yeah, that's the worst part.
The
Yeah,
worst part.
that
What's the best
sucks.
part?
The best part is leaving and going to a 5-star hotel, obviously.
Oh, did they put you up in a 5-star hotel?
Yeah, always.
Really?
Yeah.
But was that just your, because you worked for Nikki Haden.
Niki Lauda.
Yeah, I think we should go. If you've never been, Maltese hellions, tell us some more of your favorite cases. I found a few interesting ones, but I'd really love to hear yours. And we'll organize a meetup there when we finally make it. That'll be fun. Johanna, tell me about your first case.
Okay, so you haven't been to Malta, but have you ever been to Greece?
I have not. It's also really high on my list. I actually want to go to Italy, which I haven't done, end in Venice, and then take a cruise of the Greek islands from Venice and then do like the Greek mainland. I just need to win the lottery, you know. It's worth noting that like all of my life goals are pretty much travel goals. So I'm afraid I'm going to get too sick to travel, when I'm younger than most people. So it just feels more pressing, but enough of that. I really do want to see Greece. The closest I've come culturally is Cyprus. The food was amazing, but tell me about it. I want to know everything. I'm sure you've been.
Well, I went to Greece several times, but there is one special vacation that I will always remember. And it was a trip I took with my parents when I was a little kid, and we drove by car from Austria to the island of Corfu. I mean, of course, we took a ferry to go to the island. And that's like 1,600 kilometers or 995 miles. And now I know for all of you in the US that might not seem like a lot, but you mustn't forget that it was back in the summer of 1989 and the Iron Curtain was just now falling.
Oh, God, I really love how different our world perspectives were at that time. I don't think I could have even told you what the Iron Curtain was in 1989 here.
That's a great thing of the internet because we grew up completely differently and with different backgrounds, and here we are being friends.
That's amazing. It's the best.
So if you look at the map and you see all the countries you have to pass when going from Austria to Greece, you can either go to Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Macedonia, or, and that's the way we chose because back then Albania wasn't open yet. So we went through Hungary, Serbia, Macedonia, and it was a huge adventure and it took us more than 3 days to go there. I could tell you quite some funny stories from this trip, but I'm just saying this. On the way back, my parents, they were done, with all the adventures. So we just took the ferry from Greece directly to Italy. And I think this vacation was the trip that planted this little tiny seed of Wanderlust into my heart because I'm like you, most of my life goals are traveling.
Yeah, Wanderlust. It's so much better in German. Yeah, I love this so much. I can see why this would. Yeah.
Greece is beautiful and it has wonderful people and rich culture and amazing history, but Greece, like every other country on this planet, has its dark true crime moments. And one of those dark moments occurred on the 24th of July, 1991, around 2 p.m., when 21-month-old Ben Needham disappeared from his grandparents' home in the village of Iraklis on the island of Kos. He was English, but his grandparents had just bought a house there after they retired, as far as I understand.
Okay, oh boy.
Here we go, yeah.
I know.
So the first problem was, I think, that they didn't realize immediately that he was gone. And then when they finally saw the kid was not there anymore, at first they thought that Ben's teenage uncle had taken him for a ride on his moped. That didn't prove true, and the family started to search the surrounding area, thinking that the blonde British boy had just wandered off. But the boy was nowhere to be found, so they alerted the police. Unfortunately, the police suspected Ben's family to be responsible, and they failed to alarm airports and harbors immediately.
Oh no. Oh, this sounds
familiar.
Mm-hmm. And after an 11-day search, the boy was still missing, and the police had absolutely no lead of what could have possibly happened to Ben Needham.
Oh, that's so sad.
Over the years, there have been many alleged sightings of Ben, both on the Greek mainland and on the Greek islands. For example, in 1998, when a blonde 10-year-old boy was seen at a playground, and the investigators found that this kid was known as the blonde one among his friends. But they did some DNA testing, and it showed that the child was not the missing boy.
Oh, that poor kid. God, that was a bad time to be a blonde in that area. But can you imagine, like,
yeah,
being like 10 years old, and we need to test your DNA to make sure you're not this. Oh God.
Plus, I read that the family had to show photographic evidence that it's really their kid, like, you know, from when he was born and blah blah blah.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. So I guess there aren't many blondes in the area then.
Yeah, probably.
Oof, okay.
So, of course, the Needhams believed that Ben had been abducted by either child traffickers or to sell him for adoption. But Carol Sarla, she's an independent journalist who investigated the case, wrote in a Times article in 2007, and I quote, "I have repeatedly asked police and press, British and Greek, for a single example to support this rumor. There is none. When pretty little Western European kids go missing, we know about it. If we don't know, it isn't happening. Those of us who properly investigated Ben's disappearance are certain he was not abducted. A child less than two, toddling unsupervised for 5 hours on a baking, remote, inhospitable hillside that is still largely unsearched, is easy prey to the lonely accident." End quote. And it is quite possible that Ben indeed died in a horrible accident and is buried somewhere on the island.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's definitely possible. That is very young for no supervision. I mean, even in those days.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, 21 months. That's too young.
No, those are the years when they're constantly trying to kill themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Like light sockets and steps and plants and, I mean, just literally everything. Oh. Mm-hmm.
In September 2016, police informed the Needham family that they had learned that a man from Kos had said that Konstantin Barkas, a digger operator now deceased, had told him that Ben had died in an accident and that Barkas had hidden the body in building waste. On 16th of September, police began a search for the remains, and excavations were focused around a tree that was apparently planted since Ben vanished. A replica of the sandals he had been wearing was being made to see if they matched any found items. And the excavation work ended on 16th of October. More than 800 tons of soil had been dug up, with any items of interest sent back to the UK for forensic analysis. And one of the items that was found had been identified by the Needham family as being indeed in Ben's possession at the time he went missing. And this item was a little yellow toy car. And the police later stated that traces of blood had been found on the car. And I think if we ever hear news about it, we will keep you definitely updated if they ever manage to extract DNA or if they finally find Ben Needham.
Oh God, that's incredibly sad. That reminds me so much of the Madeleine McCann case, but I'd never heard that one.
Yeah, that case reminds many people of the Madeleine case. There are also a few computer-generated images, you know, that simulate the aging progress of Ben, just like they have with Maddie. And we will post them in our Facebook group because I think we agree it's always important to have this information out there.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, God, that one is sad. Okay, yeah.
What's next?
Puerto Rico. So my Puerto Rico story is about aliens, and I'm talking about UFOs, not illegal aliens, because of course Puerto Rico is a United States territory, and Puerto Ricans have been United States citizens for over 100 years. When looking for a shorter story about something happening in Puerto Rico, I found that they have what's considered to be one of the most credible videos of a UFO, which I did not expect. So, I came across an article in Newsweek that broke down a bunch of UFO sightings with the most compelling evidence, and an event in Aguadilla, Puerto Rico in April of 2013 was right at the top of that list. I'll share the video in our Facebook group because I have to admit, it's fascinating.
Why? What happened?
A U.S. Customs and Border Protection aircraft captured infrared video of an unidentified flying object seen flying at like a low altitude across the Rafael Hernandez Airport runway in Aguadilla, Puerto Rico. They know it was there for a fact. There's no question about it because its presence actually delayed the departure of a commercial aircraft leaving on time. So the video, and we'll share it, it shows this object traveling without any lights on. Sometimes at very low altitude, like below the tree line. It's also seen dipping into the water and then coming back out of the water again without looking like it slows down at all. The speeds are estimated of this thing to be around 100 miles an hour average or 161 kilometers an hour. At one point, it appears to either like split into two parts or it's joined by a second object. And then at some points, it seems to change shape slightly. So it's interesting. Definitely watch it. A source that I'm guessing is from Homeland Security, because they say that it's a vetted source. They sent a copy of this video to the SCU, which is the Scientific Coalition for, I need a definitive answer on this, don't I? It's either ufology or ufology. If someone, one of our listeners must know, so please
tell us.
Please tell us. Also, feel free to tell us all the things we've mispronounced in this one, because
it's going to be so many.
The list is long and full of terrors. So anyway, the Scientific Coalition for Ufology, the SCU, they're made up of a panel of scientific experts of all different fields, but like legit scientific experts. And so they published this incredibly long report, which we'll share.
And what did they find?
Yeah, so it's very, very long, and I'll link to it. But here are a couple of highlights. So one theory was, could it have been a balloon?
Moving that fast. I mean, yeah. How windy was it?
Yeah, not windy enough. So wind speeds at the time were like 8 to 13 miles an hour. At ground level in like 12 to 18 miles an hour at 400 to 3,200 feet. And this thing was moving way too fast to be floating on a wind current. It also changed directions from going south back to the north again. And it dips underwater and then comes back up again without ever slowing down. So
okay, wait, let me rethink that in kilometers per hour. So around 19 to 30 kilometers per hour. Okay, yeah, probably not a balloon then floating on air. What other theories are out there?
Yeah, no, definitely. Sorry, I forgot to do the kilometers on that one. So another question was, could it be a bird? Because it looks dark on the screen and when it switches over to infrared. And so with this type of thermal imaging, the dark color means it was warmer than the air.
Okay, makes sense. Could be a bird.
Yes, but the problem was, whatever this thing was, it was just moving way too fast, again, to be a bird. So peregrine falcons are awesome, and they do occasionally visit Puerto Rico, and they would be the fastest bird possible in that area. So they have an average horizontal speed of 40 to 56 miles an hour, and their maximum speed is 69 miles an hour, which is 111 kilometers an hour. So while it's a very, very fast bird, it's still not fast enough. And it doesn't explain why it wouldn't have slowed when it hit the water, right? It doesn't look like a bird to me either. I mean, I don't know what it looks like, but not a bird.
Okay, so we put a pin in the bird for now. Something mechanical then, maybe?
Maybe, right. This is probably the best possibility. The researchers looked at the possibility that this object was a drone. It's the most logical explanation, and their research did make a note that the Navy is in fact working on a drone that can fly through the air and then dive into the ocean and become a submarine, and this is called a flimmer. But current flimmer drones, they have a top airspeed of 68 miles an hour, which would be 109 kilometers an hour, and they haven't been tested underwater yet.
Flimmer, is it fly and swimmer? Because then I like it. I think it's a neat word.
I bet it is. Flimmer.
Flimmer. Would be a good name for a dog.
It would be.
Okay, so a flimmer. This could be a more advanced version of the flimmer drone.
Right, it could be. And the report does say it's possible that that is exactly what this thing is. But they do question, and so do I, why would the military test something like this over a civilian airport and not on a military base? And I agree, it seems illogical. So in conclusion, they state, quote, There is no explanation for an object capable of traveling underwater at over 90 miles an hour, which is 145 kilometers an hour, without minimal impact as it enters the water. Through the air at 120 miles an hour, 193 kilometers, at low altitude through a residential area without navigational lights, and finally to be capable of splitting into two separate objects. No bird, no balloon, no aircraft, and no known drones have that capability. End quote. Yeah, like I said, we'll post the video and I'll post the full report for you guys to take a look in the Facebook group. But it's weird. It's weird. Yeah. Did you look at the video I sent you?
I did. I mean, the shape reminds me of a drone and the movements remind me of a drone. So I probably say it's a drone, but yeah. It's definitely weird. It's weird. It's super fast.
It's so fast.
Yeah.
It's so fast. Yeah. I'm afraid it's aliens. So I don't know.
On their way to Malta. To
they're on their some, that's right yes skulls. They're just passing by, but yeah, Puerto Rico is really, really high on my list to visit. It has been since I was a kid because they have the coqui, the little tiny tree frogs, and those tree frogs, sometimes it rains frogs in Puerto Rico. True story.
Wait, what? Raining frogs, like, yes. In Magnolia.
Yes, isn't it the best? So, right, so there are these coqui, these tiny little tree frogs. They climb up into the trees at night because we all know that that's where the tastiest bugs are, right? I mean, common knowledge. But the treetops are, it's just like too hot and dry for the frogs in the daytime when they're done eating. So when morning comes, they just sort of leap from the treetops and they float down to the ground. They don't glide. There are like some species of tree frog that can glide, or like flying frogs. And that's not this. What coqui do, scientists call it parachuting. They just kind of stretch out and float down because they don't weigh very much. So then once they're back on the ground, they find some water to absorb through their skin, because that's how frogs drink, if anybody wasn't aware. And it's also why you have to be very careful handling them. But then they climb back up into the trees and repeat the process.
It's adorable. I never thought about going to Puerto Rico, but I have to admit, now I want to see the parachuting frogs.
Right? It's an actual dream of mine. Just get up early and just have all these tiny little frogs just landing all around me. I just love them so much. I used to keep tree frogs. I had a pair of green tree frogs named Tristan and Isolde. And I used to have an Australian White's tree frog named Cecil, who was actually originally Cecilia after the Simon and Garfunkel song that was on the radio.
I love that song.
Yeah. So originally my frog's name was Cecilia, but when I got him, he was teeny tiny. He would fit like on a nickel. And then one night in the middle of the night, he started calling. And I was like, you're Cecil. You're a boy. But I really, really want to visit Puerto Rico. The music, the art, the architecture. Oh, yes, please. We're going to go there too. Definitely. Johanna, where does our next journey around the world take us?
Well, I have a story from one of your other bucket list places, Italy.
Oh, I want to go there so badly.
So Italy is one of the neighbor countries of Austria. And of course, like most Austrians, I have been to Italy a few times already, which sounds super snobby right now, but it is what it is.
No, it doesn't. But how far is Italy from you? Like, if you got in the car to go to Italy, how?
Well, from Vienna, where I live now, I would be there in around, across the border, 4 hours maybe. But right, if you live in Carinthia, you just cross the border and you're there.
Right. So you can go in 4 hours. That's how long it takes me to drive to New York. We go to New York, like sometimes we go a few times a year. Yeah. It's just that in Europe, you get to go to another country.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been to all the states in New England. So there.
But like, that's my bucket list, you see.
Yeah, that's right. But it's just so different. You know,
yeah,
it's
like, it is.
It's just amazing.
One of my favorite cities in Italy is Venice. And Annie, I know you will love it when you go there. And I know some might say, ugh, Venice is so boring and it's so cliche.
No.
A lot of people. Yeah, really. A lot of people.
Really?
But, yeah. But I think it's beautiful and it's mysterious and it's really, really special.
Oh, it's right on the top of my list. I've never been, obviously. Venice has always called to me. You know how I love the water. Mm. You know, plus I literally live on pasta and cheese.
So listen, I know a lot of tourists are very disappointed when they get to Venice because, you know, it's not what they imagined or what they made it out to be. But I let you on a little secret of mine. The best time to see Venice Is not carnival, or worse, even summer, the best time to go and visit La Serenissima is November. Because during summer, Venice is packed with day tourists. You know, they come from places like Jesolo or Bibiona. In November, the city is almost empty. And during the day, you can have warm and sunny weather. But during the evening, the fog creeps from the lagoon through the city. And that's when Venice shows its true magic.
Yes, I want to go.
Because when you stroll through the narrow and winding streets in this marvelous city, you can't help but admire the wonderful architecture of the old palazzos. And Annie, I know you love some good house porn.
Oh, you know I do. I have chills right now. Are you busy this November?
I literally will always make time to go to Venice. Oh, and plus, Philip has never been there. So you and Paul, you need to come and we go, the four of us.
I'm going to actually talk to him about that.
Yeah, really? It's fun. You're going to visit Vienna and we're going to go to
Venice.
Anyway, maybe when we're there, while we walk on the cobblestone, you might start to wonder about all the lives that started and ended behind the walls of those old, old houses. And there is one house that is rather infamous for seeing a lot of lives end. And the name of the house is Palazzo Dario.
Tell me everything.
So it is situated in the Dorso Duro Quarter, directly on the bank of the Canale Grande. And while the main part of the house is Italian Gothic, the house front that faces the famous canal is actually Italian Renaissance because of later renovations. It has beautiful marble ornaments, and during yet another renovation in the 19th century, a neo-Gothic balcony was added to the front, and the balcony is overlooking the canal. Even though it may not be one of the grandest palazzos in the city, it is often named as one of the most beautiful and charming ones. It is owned privately, so usually it is not open to the public, but I heard that sometimes they host art exhibitions for the Guggenheim Museum. So if you ever have the chance to visit, you might want to go.
Oh, no might about it. I want to go. Oh, wait, or do I want to go? Wait, tell me more. I don't know if I want to go or not.
Let's see. Well, the construction was started in the year 1479, which is 500 years before I was born. And the house was finished in 1487. The first owner of the palazzo was Giovanni Dario. He was the secretary to the Venetian state. And after his death, it was passed on to his daughter Marietta. And with her starts the series of violent and tragic deaths that gave the Palazzo Dario the reputation of being cursed.
Oh, what happened?
So, Marietta was married to Vincenzo Barbaro, the son of another very famous and very wealthy Venetian family. But after Vincenzo lost all of his money with her failed business ventures, she committed suicide.
Oh, so it was not a love match then. So, like, if he wasn't sure if she loved him for his money or for, like, his sense of humor, like, he got his answer, am I right?
I think the only possibility for the answer being any clearer would have been if she had painted it on the walls of their home.
It's so bad.
Well, it is bad because Vincenzo too suffered a very violent death because he was stabbed.
Oh no! Oh, that's awful. I feel badly for him.
I couldn't find out what happened to him, but I like to imagine that he owed some money because of his business ventures that failed and, you know, somebody.
Plus, I bet his bitch wife spent them down to nothing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So,
I didn't know her. I shouldn't speak badly of her.
I'm sure they were lovely, lovely people.
Lovely people.
So the house then belonged to their son, who was killed in Crete.
Mm.
So the Ca Dario, which is the Casa Dario, the Palazzo Dario, later on was sold to Arbit Abdol, and he was an Armenian merchant, and he ended up bankrupt shortly after buying the infamous house. And on we go, because in 1838, Radon Brown, an English scientist, bought the palazzo. But only 4 short years later, he not only was bankrupt, but also his homosexual relationship was discovered. And back in those days, that was a huge scandal. So Radon Brown and his partner committed suicide in the Palazzo Dario. One of the next owners was the American Charles Briggs, and he had to leave Venice after his homosexuality was outed. He fled to Mexico, where his partner committed suicide.
Oh, man. Now that is all heartbreaking. Also, Radon Brown, that's a fucking cool name, man. I feel like there should be like a children's book with like this guy named Radon Brown. He's a kid, but he's like science geeky, but like solves mysteries, like a nerdy Nancy Drew.
I see him as like a private investigator.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. But he solves all his mysteries with science.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
We should write that book.
We
should. Don't steal our idea.
Yeah, that's copyrighted. Copyright Fresh Hell Podcast. Let's remember. See, now everyone will remember that name, Radon Brown.
Yeah, see?
Damn.
So, next, 1964. The famous Italian tenor Mario Del Monaco planned to buy the palace. But on his way to Venice to finalize the contract, he was involved in a very serious car accident that caused a long rehabilitation. And so the singer decided against the purchase. A few years later, the Cardario was bought by Count Filippo Giordano delle Lanze. Mm. I love those names.
Yeah.
He was a nobleman from Turin, and he was killed inside the building in 1970 by a Croatian sailor named Raul Blasic, with whom he had a relationship. The murder weapon, you might ask? A vase. Blasic then fled to London, where he himself was murdered.
Okay, this is amazing. I mean, it's awful, but wow. Okay.
So murdered by a vase.
Uh-huh.
All right. This is awful. Tell me more.
I knew you would love this story.
Okay. You know I do.
So the palace was later bought by Kit Lampert, and you might know him as the manager of The Who. He died very shortly after in London falling downstairs. And although he had claimed to not believe in the curse, Lampert had told some friends to sleep in the nearby Hotel Criti to, and I quote, escape the ghosts that haunted him in the palace.
Really? I didn't know that about Kit Lambert. Yeah, The Who are one of my absolute favorite bands. Paul and I actually, our first dance at our wedding was a Pete Townsend song.
Really? Yeah, they are not the Beach Boys, but they are. Okay. I'm kidding. The Who are great. So, next. Fabrizio Ferrari. Is there any name that could be more Italian? I don't think so.
Are they all the same family? Like, are the Ferraris all...
I guess. I honestly, I don't know. I guess.
I don't either. Okay.
But it's a fucking cool name.
It's the best, right?
So, Fabrizio Ferrari bought the house in the 80s, and he moved there with his sister Nicoletta. Ferrari did not die, yay, but he lost all of his assets after taking possession of the building. His sister did die in a car accident without any witnesses.
Oh, shit. No, that's sad. Okay, tell me more.
So, late 80s, the building was purchased by the financier Raul Giardini, who planned to give it to his daughter. Giardini, after a series of economic setbacks, committed suicide in 1993 under very, very weird and unclear circumstances. So after the death of Giardini, no one wanted to buy the Palazzo Dario anymore. And the first brokerage company that had been hired to sell it, they finally gave up trying to sell it.
Oh, right.
At the end of the 90s, the director, Woody Allen, seemed willing to buy the building, but he never went through with it.
Oh, I wish he had. I hate Woody Allen so much.
Ugh, so overrated.
Ugh.
I'm sure you don't only mean that in regards of his super pretentious movies.
No. All right.
So, in 2002, a week after renting the Cardario for a vacation in Venice, the bass player, John Entwistle, died because of a heart attack.
Oh, gosh. Another Who connection.
So, and as I mentioned before, the Palazzo Dario is now privately owned by an American company. What's interesting to know, there is an inscription on the outside of the Palazzo which reads in Latin, and I'm sorry if I completely hacked the pronunciation, Urbis genio Ioannes Darius, and that translates roughly to the genius Giovanni Dario. People now have pointed out that the anagram of the otherwise noble saying actually can be read as sub ruina insidiosa geniero. Roughly translates to I bring treacherous ruins.
Oh, okay. So now I want a t-shirt that just says I bring treacherous ruins. Holy hell. Joe, that was one of my favorites. That was awful. But like in the best way.
I knew you're going to like it. And if we ever make merchandise, we need to offer these shirts.
Yeah, definitely.
We're going to be the only ones to wear them probably, but we need them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'll give my dad doesn't really wear t-shirts ever. My dad like lives in khakis and like a blue striped button down shirt, even when he mows the lawn. Like then he puts on sneakers. It's really funny. But just recently, like the last couple of years, like in his retirement, in his dotage, he's kind of like relaxed into it. And he wears jeans sometimes, which is crazy. And then he wears t-shirts now. So like whatever merch we buy, if we ever make any kind of merch, I'm just going to constantly make my dad wear my t-shirts everywhere. Thing is, he would.
But it could have the saying in Latin in the front, and then when he turns around.
That would be fun.
He's going to like the Latin, I'm sure.
He will.
All right, Annie, where are you taking us next?
All right. So next, we're going to Sweden. There are a lot of great cases in Sweden. But when I was trying, and we're going to cover them because you guys have some, you guys have some good stuff. But I came across this terrible tale of the Atlas Vampire. So let's talk about him. Atlas Vampire is the name of an unknown assailant who committed the unsolved vampire murder in Stockholm, Sweden in 1932. This is the unsolved murder of Lily Lindström. On May 4th, 1932, Lily Lindström, who was a 32-year-old sex worker, was found murdered in her apartment in the Atlas area of Stockholm near Sankt Eriksplan. A few days earlier, Lily had popped into her neighbor's apartment. Her neighbor and very good friend was named Minnie Jansen, and she was another sex worker. Lily had popped over to see if she had any extra condoms before returning to her own rather small, you know, a sad flat where she was going to meet a client. As I said, Minnie was her friend. It was common for them to like borrow stuff and check in on each other. And so when Minnie didn't see Lily the next day, and then she, I guess she like listened through the wall for a while just to see, you know, just constantly checking to see if she could hear anything. And when she couldn't, she called the police. Unfortunately, it looks like Lily had been dead for 2 to 3 days before police broke into her apartment, so probably killed the same night that she had last seen Minnie. And it was a shocking scene. Articles say that according to the police report, Lily was found face down on the bed. She was naked with her clothes neatly folded on her chair next to the bed. It was evident that sexual activity had taken place because there was a used condom still in her rectum. Her cause of death was massive blunt force trauma to the head. And then things got really problematic. The detectives found a bloody gravy ladle, and on further inspection of the body, they realized that her body seemed to have been drained of all of her blood. Saliva was found on Lily's neck and body. Not surprising if she was involved in consensual sex, but police soon began to fear that that blood-stained gravy ladle that they found had been used to drink her blood, and that's how the name the Atlas Vampire came to be. So, of course, her clients fell under suspicion, but after a lengthy investigation, no one was charged with her murder. Neighborhood was questioned, no leads ever surfaced. And of course, there was a wealth of DNA evidence, right, at the scene, but it would have been completely useless in 1932, and the murder remains unsolved to this day. Now, please take this particular story with a grain of salt, because I found this story in a couple of different places, but I couldn't really find any original sources for the things I found the way I normally do, the way I normally research, and any articles I found were in a language that I couldn't actually read. So I couldn't validate any of this, and the thing that really worries me is that the photo everyone is using as the crime scene photo, I'm like 99.999% certain it's Lincoln's deathbed photo. So, yeah.
I mean, it makes sense because, you know, don't forget Abraham Lincoln was the vampire killer.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I mean, it all comes full circle. So, yeah, if you are in Sweden, could you let me know, like, have you heard this story before? Do you know if this is actually true? I don't know. The Lincoln's death scene really worries me. So, I don't know.
I don't want to say fun story. It's an interesting story, though. It's a good story.
There was saliva on her neck. So that means that she was, you know, bitten. I don't think that's how they drained all her blood. So this has been bothering me about the story. If she died from 2 blunt force trauma wounds to her head, I don't understand how they would have gotten all the blood out of her. Like, it just, the whole story doesn't really make sense.
I mean, also the several times that they mention the condom, I mean, I know they existed in the 30s, but were they really that common that you go to your neighbor?
I wondered about that too.
Colleague and borrow condoms.
Yeah, but I think you literally borrowed them, because back then, didn't you reuse them over and over again? Didn't you like wash them out? And then I think you reused them. I don't know.
Just don't plant any pictures in my head.
I think, you know, I'm remembering it from Downton Abbey, you know, the episode where Lady Mary sends Anna.
I don't know. Weren't they made of like
sheepskin, right?
Listen, we don't know. we're just making it worse. We're only making the story more horrific. Johanna, listen, do you have a condom I could borrow? I'll give it back to you tomorrow so you can use it. All right.
Sorry.
What do you have for us?
It's not getting better. It's getting worse now. Brace yourself.
All right.
So the last story, my last story for today, takes us to Southeast Asia. And I was so excited to see that we have a couple of listeners from Singapore. Because when I was working as a flight attendant, I used to go to Singapore very, very often. At least once a month, I would either fly from Vienna to Kuala Lumpur and then on to Sydney, or I would go Vienna, Singapore, Melbourne. And Singapore is amazing. I mean, I love to go to Sentosa Island with the cable car. So, and then you can tour the island via monorail. And I love to eat stingray from one of the street food stalls. And you would love that. You can visit their amazing zoo by night and you can look at all the nocturnal animals.
Okay. First, you know I love nocturnal animals. I do. I love them. But also eating stingray. I don't know why I never thought about people eating them. I swam with them a couple of times in the Bahamas. I love them. They rub against you like cats, but they feel like mushrooms. Weird and wonderful. But do they taste fishy or do they taste like chicken?
They taste like chicken.
Ah.
And is it bad that I say I would love to swim with them and then eat them?
No, that's okay.
They taste really good. I'm sorry. It tastes
do they?
Yeah, it tastes really, really good. And I had the best party nights in my life in Singapore, like Souk. That's a discotheque that was my favorite place to go. And Singapore is so clean, you know, they were very strict about it. And it shows. It's you can't import chewing gum. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, you can't. They sell it only for medical reasons. So if you ever have the chance to go to Singapore, please do so. It's awesome.
I promise I will.
So Singapore is not only clean, it's also extremely safe. Like I read somewhere that it has one of the lowest crime rates in the world.
Oh, nice. Yeah, my sister Lucy and her family just got back. They love it there, but I, you know, it's on the list. I promise. I'll go.
Even in a safe place like Singapore, you know, now and then horrible things do happen. Like, for example, in 1981 with the so-called Toh Payoh ritual murders, and I asked a friend from Malaysia to tell me how to pronounce it, and I'm sure I'm completely ruining it right now.
No, is that Nina?
Yes, it's Nina. Hi, Nina. Thanks for telling us. She has a lovely voice, by the way. She sent me a voice recording. So, the Toh Payoh ritual murders. Adrian Lim, he was a self-proclaimed spirit medium. He claimed that he could communicate with supernatural beings, and even though he was a Catholic, he prayed to gods of many different religions, so he was able to provide service to as many customers as possible. And his clients were not only superstitious men and women, but also very often bar girls, dancers, or sex workers. He promised them to increase their beauty and charm through his ritual massage, which required him also to have sex with his clients. You can already imagine where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
So another one of his treatments.
You're doing your air quotes.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing air quotes right now. The treatment. They involved electroshock therapy. For this, he placed his clients' feet in a tub of water, attached wires to their temples, and passed electricity through them. This was supposed to help them against migraines and ward off evil spirits.
Well, shit. I mean, I've tried pretty much everything for migraines. I mean, I literally have just a face full of botulism right now, but I am not down for electrocution. I don't really feel like it would help. I think it's a bad idea, and I'm going to say it publicly. Don't do it. Oh my God, this guy he's a monster.
Yeah, you know why he used the electricity, the electroshock therapy? Because when he was young, he learned to be an electrician.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a waste of money. His parents must be proud.
We're still laughing, but it's going to stop soon.
It's so bad. I swear, the worse it gets, the more I laugh. It's my it's my defense mechanism.
Yeah, you always laugh a lot with my cannibal stories.
I do, because it's so awful. I just immediately start joking. My dad does the same thing. Anytime there's terrible news, we'll just start joking in a very inappropriate manner.
So back to our nice spirit medium, because of course this guy was a total fraud and he preyed on gullible people who had deep personal problems. You know, that really he was an asshole. And he learned all the scams and tricks from one of his uncles. And one of the tricks he very often used to convince his clients was the old needle in the egg thing.
Wait, I don't know what the needle in the egg thing is. Can you tell me more?
You never heard about that?
No.
Okay. So he would carefully insert a blackened needle into a raw egg, making sure to close the tiny hole in the shell again with some powder. I don't know, like, I have no idea what they use. Then in a ritual, he would move the egg over his customer's head, probably saying things like, Hocus Pocus Fidibus or something like this. And then he would open the egg and show them the needle inside. And that was a proof that evil spirits had latched onto them. Of course, he could get rid of those nasty little spirits for a nice sum of money.
Oh, this stuff makes me so angry. Also, I kind of want to do that to somebody now. Because I don't think that's a known thing here. All right.
Yeah, but don't forget the magic words.
Yeah, those are key.
So, of course, he also had two holy wives.
Sorry, I just thought they should be in Latin. The magic words. That's how spells go wrong. It's our lack of Latin. Okay, sorry.
I'm sure if we would do that, we would like summon some horrible, nasty,
awful,
annoying demon. He wouldn't even be evil. He would be just so super annoying, correcting us all the time.
He just cooks fish in the microwave all day. Chews with his mouth open. Never puts down the toilet seat. God, that is what we would summon, isn't it?
I think that's what marriage is to other people.
Okay. Oh, God.
So.
Wow.
Marriage.
Yes. Marriage.
So also our spirit medium was married and he had two holy wives. The first one was Catherine Dan Muichu. And she worked as a bar girl and met Adrian Lim through a co-worker. She had just lost her beloved grandmother and she was estranged from the rest of the family, so she was kind of the perfect victim for him. She visited Adrian Lim more frequently, their relationship grew more and more intimate, and they finally registered their marriage. Adrian Lim dominated Catherine and he abused her physically and emotionally. And despite the abuse, she stayed with him and she became his assistant.
That poor woman.
So his second holy wife was Ho Ka Hong, and she was brought to Adrian Lim by her mother. She wanted him to treat her violent and volatile temper and was immediately convinced by, you know it, the egg trick. So Ho became a loyal follower and Adrian wanted to make her his second wife. But there was a tiny problem. Ho was already married.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't he want to make her his second wife if she's both violent and volatile? I mean,
right?
That's lovely. You don't find both of those together all the time. But wait, he's also married, so.
Yeah, but he was a very special spiritual medium and rules don't apply to him.
Okay.
Nevertheless, Ho left her home and moved in with Adrian and Catherine. Ho's husband came looking for her and the trio convinced him to participate in one of the electroshock therapies. He said yes, and that was a big mistake because Adrian Lim simply electrocuted his rival.
That's shocking. Sorry. Straight to hell. I'm going straight to hell. That is awful. Who are these people?
They're the worst. They're really the worst.
Yeah.
Now, if you would think that Adrian Lim would have gotten into any trouble for killing a man, you are wrong. Because Ho simply made a statement that her husband got electrocuted in her bedroom through a faulty light switch. And that was pretty much it.
Really? No one was even like, hey, you should probably get that light switch looked at. Like, just nothing?
Maybe they told her, yeah, just don't touch it anymore, just leave.
Sorry, ma'am, listen, you're going to have to, this light's going to be on until it burns out. Wow.
So Adrian Lim, he continued to trick people until he was faced with rape accusations. Of course he was, because it just fits.
Of course.
He had used a sedative on several occasions to drug and sexually abuse one of his clients. Now, he had a great idea about how he could get out of this trouble. So to derail investigations, he decided that he would best distract the police through a couple of child murders.
What? Oh, shit. No, I did not see that coming. Oh, boy. No.
So what he did is he told his wives that he was possessed by Kali, you know, the Hindu goddess of creation, destruction and time.
Of course, I know Kali. Everyone knows Kali.
And he convinced them to abduct and murder two children in order to please Kali. So the first victim was a 9-year-old girl who they met at a church and they lured her back to their apartment. And now is where it gets really bad. So the trio sedated her, drew her blood to drink it, and smeared the blood on a portrait of the goddess Kali. Then they smothered her with a pillow and, you know, just to make sure that she was really dead, electrocuted her. Then they put her in a bag and placed her near an elevator in a different block of their apartment complex. And their apartment complex was called Topayo, so that's where the name of the case comes from. The second victim was a 9-year-old boy they lured into their home just 1 week after the first murder. But with him, the sedative didn't work and the boy struggled for a really long time. So the trio decided to tie him up and they stunned him through karate chops to the neck.
What the actual fuck? Stunned him with karate chops to the neck.
Yeah. The karate chops also killed him. Then they once more drew the blood, drank it, and they drowned the victim, again, to make sure that he is really dead. And then they put him in a bag and got rid of the child's body in the same way as the first victim. He was bleeding out of his nose because of the karate chops, apparently. Hmm. And thank God the three were not the smartest, because they left a trail of blood that led the police directly to Adrian Lim's door.
Okay. Wow. This is beyond awful. I wish you could see my face. I think my jaw was just unhinged like a snake for most of that description. That's just, it's unimaginable.
It's really the worst.
It's awful.
So thank God they caught them. And after a trial that lasted 41 days, Adrian Lim, Catherine Tan, and Ho Ka Hong were found guilty of murder and sentenced to death by hanging.
Good. I hope it wasn't one of those long drop, quick hangings. I learned a lot about these, didn't we, during the Rebecca Zahau case. It's horrible to say, but I hope their death was a slow, strangly kind. That was horrific. I mean, when you're that bad and that diabolical and that predatory, and then you get caught, and so you think the best way to distract the police is to torture and murder children, like, it just doesn't really get any worse than that, does it? All right. Well, I'm glad I told you that I had one that was a happy, funny one, kind of. Okay, so to end on a happy note, I found an article about a haunted Polish castle, and now I am completely obsessed, and I want to go here immediately. I'm just going to go ahead and actually read you all this article. I'll share the link. It's culture.poland website, and it's amazing. So, this is the article. Built in the 13th century, Zocha Castle owes its current design to Ernst Gutzschow. This German entrepreneur bought the building in 1909 and rebuilt according to 18th century illustrations. Maybe it's the old-fashioned stone walls, the moat, and lofty towers that make the castle such a hot spot for ghosts. Despite its picturesque location in Zocha, so now I'm still reading from this article, but please pardon my pronunciation. Near the Leśniański Lake in the Sudets, the castle is often called, quote, a ghost fortress, and not without reason. Each square meter of its premises is inhabited by spirits. You hear that, Joe? Each square meter.
That's a whole lot of spirits. Like, that's more spirits than in 13 ghosts.
I haven't seen 13 ghosts. Is it scary?
I don't think it would scare you. They're just really mean ghosts.
13 mean ghosts?
Yeah. 13 mean ghosts, yeah.
I feel like that's like 12 too many mean ghosts in one place. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, they're all locked up in glass cages.
Okay.
In the cellar. I mean, no wonder that they're so super mean, because...
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be in a locked cage in the basement. Yeah, fair enough. All right. So this is the best, and by the best, of course, you know, I mean the worst part of the article. So, quote, visitors have a ghost of a chance to meet its first inhabitants on the bridge that leads into the castle gates. There are the spirits of mourners who attended a funeral procession in 1719. The bridge collapsed underneath them, and the unfortunate wretches drowned in the moat. Their moans, in turn, are drowned out by the cries that come from the well in the courtyard.
A whole lot of noise.
Right? It sounds like this is like a cursy a place as your villa. Like, don't you think we have to go and see for ourselves which is louder, the moans and screams coming from the moat or the shrieking coming from the well? I mean, what do you think?
Well, okay, in Austria we have a legend of a woman who was thrown into a well as a punishment. I don't remember what she did, but it was kind of sucky. So yeah. Off in the well you go. Apparently, ghosts in wells can get pretty damn loud, and I guess it has something to do with the acoustics. So my first impulse is to say, well is louder than moat. But I need to know who's in the well.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked. So I also, now I want to sing in a well. Just to hear the acoustics.
And do interpretive dance.
And there's not enough space in a well for an interpretive dance. Also,
try harder.
I don't know. I'd have to get more creative.
God, now I'm thinking of what was the name of the poor girl that fell down the well?
Oh,
baby Jessica.
Yes, I remember that very clearly.
Me too. She didn't dance. Yeah.
No, she was too small to have any really solid moves. Sorry. All right, she's fine. Okay. So in our well, though, this well at this castle, whose name I'm not going to pronounce again, in Poland, but I'll link to it because seriously, it looks amazing. So it's the cry, quote, of the unfaithful wife of Joachim von Nitzitz. Does that sound about right? It's a German name. So he was one of the castle owners. As punishment, he ordered that his wife be drowned in the well. Her child, a fruit of her love affair, was bricked up in the castle's chimney.
Ooh, they love to do that.
And even today, the cries of the baby can be heard in the castle walls.
Oh, there you go. Another punished wife in a well.
I know. Okay. So but do you think that this hotel also uses that ghost baby as an excuse for noise complaints with, like, real babies, though? like you check into this, like, Polish Hogwarts, like, gorgeous hotel, and then there's a sound of a baby crying in the middle of the night, so you call down to reception, and you're like, yeah, hi, sorry, there's a screaming baby, and it's 2 a.m., and then the lady at the front desk is like, oh, sorry, love to help, but that's actually a ghost baby. Maybe just, like, open the window, and hopefully the screaming from the well and the moat will just drown that baby right out. So you sleep well now. Like, how did that even work?
I don't know. You have to bring your noise-canceling headset, definitely.
You're right.
I'm not sure, you know, kids are not so my thing. And I'm not sure if I prefer real babies or ghost babies. But surprisingly, I might go with real babies here.
Yeah. Ghost babies are never good. I'll take a cranky real baby every time. All right. Article continues. Quote, the castle's owners generally seemed to be very unlucky with women. Gutschau used to throw his unfaithful wives, apparently he'd had several spouses, straight into the castle's dungeon through a secret trapdoor hidden in his bedroom. Even today, their poor souls remain imprisoned in the maze of underground corridors.
Wow. Trapdoor hidden in the bedroom. I mean, that must have been Henry VIII's dream house.
Oh my God, right? Yeah. Not only Henry VIII, but I bet H.H. Holmes would have loved that. And of course, Simpsons did it. So, all right. So, and then it continues. But that is not all. Another ghostly encounter awaits. The oldest ghostly resident, the White Lady.
Oh, good, good. Because it's not a proper haunting without a lady in, you know, some color or another.
Yeah, you gotta have a lady in color.
Yeah.
Unless it's the lady in red, because then she's probably just dancing with you. So according to this article, she is the apparition of Gertrude, who used to live in this castle with her brother during the 15th century. So they had a really bad argument, and to take vengeance on her sibling, she set the Hussites on him. I had to look up what Hussites were, and they were like the Czech people, Bohemia. But I feel like I want more info here, you know, like... Like,
I mean, what was the argument about? Like, you didn't bring the waste outside, the trash can is full, or there's no toilet paper?
I mean, maybe.
And then she called the Hussites and she's like, seize him.
Exactly. But the article says they did not conquer the castle. Gertrude the traitor, in turn, was beheaded and cursed by her sibling. This is why she cannot even enter the gates of hell. She is doomed to roam the castle for eternity. Nowadays, this Polish Hogwarts houses a hotel. Everyone can spend a night within its walls to see for themselves whether there is a grain of truth in the old ghost stories. End quote. I bet there's at least one grain. If there's like one grain of truth and some pierogies, I'm in. So.
I mean, hey, Polish Hogwarts, that's all I need to know. We're going.
We're totally going. How many people are in Poland that listen to this? At least one, right? So let's see if we can get enough of you together to have a meetup at this Polish Hogwarts. I'll post a photo and a link to this article. I really loved it. Made me want to go to Poland. So
a mission accomplished, I'd say.
Listen, we really hope that you've enjoyed this compilation of terrible short stories and us being a little bit more chit-chatty than usual. We'll be back to our normal episodes next week. Thanks so much for all your support, everyone. Come say hi on social media, join the Facebook group, and of course, we're on Instagram, and you can email us at freshhellpodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, please. You would help us out immensely if you take a moment to subscribe and leave a review.
Tell your friends. So, until next week, if you're going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye.
Do you want to hear a story from our trip to Greece?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So as I said, that was the summer of 1989, and that was literally the summer the Iron Curtain started to open. And so my parents and our neighbor decided we should drive to Greece. They wanted to surprise my aunt and her husband. They were flying to Greece that same summer, but an airfare for the three of us, that was way too expensive for my parents. So okay, road trip it was. Don't forget, back then, you didn't have like highways everywhere. No, because we often had to drive through little villages. So somewhere in Yugoslavia, yes, back then it was still Yugoslavia, in a tiny town or tiny village where they still had like a photo of Tito hanging on the wall of the store. Yeah, we stopped. We stopped to stretch our legs and to buy some snacks. Our neighbor decides to use our one and only key to the car to open his bottle. And of course, the key breaks.
No.
The best part, my dad had a huge key opener on his key ring.
Oh no. Yes. Oh my God. Your dad must have been.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, all the grown-ups are kind of freaking out. You know, what are we going to do? We're in the middle of nowhere in a country that was difficult to visit only a couple of weeks earlier. Nobody spoke the language.
Wow. So what ended up happening? Did you guys get into some like elaborate charades?
No. Thank God an expat was there at the moment. He was visiting his family. And the expat, he was living in Austria now. So,
wow.
So he sent some kids to go and look for the locksmith. So the kids run off. And shortly after they come back and an old guy is following them. It was the locksmith. As he took a key from another car. It was not even the same brand as our car. And he honed it down, you know, to fit our car. What can I tell you? My dad could start the car. So, yay! Mission accomplished.
Yay, that's amazing.
But the locksmith warned my dad never to take the key out of the ignition because he would not be able to get it back in. So, okay, great. Thank you. Noted. Everybody's happy. My dad tries to give him money. No, he didn't accept any payment. So, like, those were amazing people, like, so welcoming and friendly.
That's amazing.
Okay, so off we go on our merry way heading towards Greece. Now, Albania didn't open up in 1989. I think that was like in 1991 or so that they opened the borders. We couldn't go through Albania. We had to go around. For our teenage listeners, do you know how we navigated our cars in the 80s without GPS? Ah, that's right, road maps. So my dad has this big European road map book. Yes, book. And there he had the whole trip planned out. You know, he was sitting evening after evening, you know, marking all the roads that he was going to drive on his way to Greece.
Yes, my dad still has those books. And I still have a bunch of like really big travel maps for my car because of my dad. But I'm amazed at the idea of like, we couldn't go through this country. So we had to go around.
Yeah.
Like that's, yeah.
It's weird. No, you can't imagine these kind of things nowadays anymore. Anyway, so, back to the Greece story. So we drive in the middle of the night. My mom is telling my dad the directions. All of a sudden, we are on this dirt road, you know, like the roads between fields. And my dad follows the road for a while. And of course, he's telling my mom she had sent him the wrong way and we're not right here. That's not possible. All of a sudden, a huge sign appears in the headlights of the car. On it, in some language nobody could understand, something written. And below it, huge letters, "Welcome to Albania." So my dad, realizing very slowly what he just saw, drives a little further and then stops the car. Everybody's silent. Like, fuck, did we just cross the Albanian border illegally? That's bad. That's really bad. All of a sudden, we see lights coming, heading in our direction. For sure, border patrol. Oh, everybody freaks out. What are we going to do? And we're in so much trouble now. It's really bad.
That's, yeah.
So my dad gets out of the car and he takes his huge flashlight. Like, you know, these huge flashlights that have a handle on it and you can carry it like a suitcase.
I do. Yeah,
that's the kind I'm talking about. So he points the light in the direction of the headlights that are coming our way. The headlights stop, not moving. All you can hear is the noise of the motorbikes. Everybody's quiet. Finally, the lights start moving again. They're coming closer and closer until we see it's bikers. And they're tourists with Austrian license plate.
Oh, God. And I literally had sweaty hands listening to this story.
They, too, had thought that they had crossed the border illegally, and they believed my dad and his flashlight to be the border patrol.
Oh, shit.
So they were also like, fuck, what are we doing? Everybody realized they were on the right road. I think the road was just under construction or something like this, and they hadn't crossed the border to Albania, but apparently we were pretty close.
That's amazing.